Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Level Up, your weekly deep dive into complexity and where we challenge ourselves to think a little bit differently about the world we live in today. Joining me on the show is Ms. Brooke Goldstein, founder and director of Lawfare Project, a human rights fighter, a lawyer, an author, and filmmaker, and a passionate advocate for free speech and the civil rights of Jewish communities around the world.
Hi, I'm Brooke Goldstein. I'm the director and founder of the Lawfare Project and the End Jew Hatred Movement. And I'm so excited to be here on the Level Up podcast with Pumi. And I am absolutely loving South Africa.
Brooke, I am particularly excited to have you on. And thank you so much for, in this very busy schedule, making the time to chat with me. And to jump straight into it, because there's so many things you've done. You've done so much, starting with making a film all those many years ago. I'm really interested to know why that is where you started your career, why you wanted to make that film, and what motivated you to make the film.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me and for your flexibility with the time. I'm really honored to be here. I've been looking forward to sitting down with you for a really long time. Yes, my career actually did start in documentary filmmaking, and then it went into law. I was actually in my third year of law school when I started filming for a documentary called The Making of a Martyr. And really what inspired me was I happened to be taking a class called Human Rights and the Child. And we were learning about all of the conventions and treaties that made up international law as it protects the child, whether it's the UN Charter or the Convention on Children's Rights and so forth. And we were actually learning a lot about child soldiers in Africa. And I came home one day and I turned on the TV. And their broadcast before me was an image of a 15-year-old physically handicapped, rumored to be mentally handicapped Palestinian Muslim boy named Hussam Abdu with live explosives strapped around his waist and his arms in the air. It turns out he was recruited by an Islamist terrorist group, the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades. He was paid the equivalent of $20 to take his own life, and he was told to go blow himself up amongst the Palestinians waiting online to get into Israel. And at that point, something occurred to me. Right? The child suicide homicide bomber is as much a victim as of a human rights abuse as is a child soldier recruited towards violence, because they are young, they are impressionable, they are manipulated, and they are basically recruited against their will to perform violent activities, and in this particular circumstance, suicide homicidal activities. And yet the whole world, for some reason, has moral clarity when it comes to condemning the use of children as child soldiers in conflicts here in Africa. The whole world was not condemning the use of Muslim children towards for suicide homicide attacks to be used as child soldiers, because it didn't serve their politics. And what was remarkable to me is all of these organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers had never once released a coherent or consistent condemnation of the use of Muslim children and the indoctrination of Muslim children towards violence, because they did not want to touch theologically motivated warfare.
So theologically motivated warfare is a fantastic way of describing this, you know. And as you then call yourself more a civil rights lawyer than a human rights lawyer, do you want to tell us a little bit more about why this particular distinction as it pertains for you with Jewish civil rights?
I'm really happy that you asked that question, because actually just today I was thinking about how here in South Africa you have a human rights tradition, less a civil rights tradition, and it was puzzling to me. I guess I'm both. I'm both a human rights lawyer and a civil rights lawyer, because I started my career with what I believe to be the greatest crime against humanity, which is the destruction of a child's future by recruiting that child into hostile activities. And then later in my career, I switched to First Amendment, free speech, constitutionally protected civil rights, and now obviously focus on the application of Jewish civil rights, mostly in North America. So I do both. I do it all.
Well, the reason, and funny that you talk about how here in South Africa, we see more human rights than civil rights, the way that it is described in America, in North America. Because there's a really fantastic story that is told by Robert Sobukwe to his biographer in his book, How Can Man Die Better, about how when he was in prison, a political prisoner, all the political prisoners were in one political prison. I don't know if you've seen number four at the fort where our constitutional court is now. That used to be a place where they held political prisoners. And it tells the story of how they had to be in two lines, the white political prisoners and the black political prisoners on their way to see the doctor. And that on the white, in the white queue, all of those people were Jewish, because we have this shared history where a very big and multicultural way of seeing the fight in South Africa for freedom and human rights for all South Africans. And in the past 2 years, I think we have seen quite a growing, since October 11, we've seen both here at home and worldwide, growing incidences of anti-Semitism being reported in Europe, in America, and here at home, we have quite a lot of activists that have conflated, I think, the idea of Jewishness and Zionism. Is there a difference, or is it all one thing?
Okay. Lots of really good points there. I want to start unpacking it with what you said initially about the fact that all of the prisoners there were Jewish, right? First of all, the white. Well, Jews are not white, okay? Some Jews can be white presenting because we were colonized. We were forcefully taken out of Judea. Jews are from Judea, otherwise known now as the West Bank, which is the incorrect term. It's Judea. We were taken out. We were dispersed throughout the world. We were colonized. We were raped. A lot of us, skin color became white if we were taken to Europe. If we stayed in the Middle East, we are dark. You know that there's black Jews. I've been to Ethiopia, to Gondar, where there's a black community there of ancient Jews that we think came directly from Egypt. So the Jewish identity, right, is the issue. It's not the skin color. It's the religion that you ascribe to, and that is Torah law. So the whole repositioning of the Jew as white, as colonial, as the oppressor of the indigenous so-called Palestinians is a historically revisionist narrative. And it's ironic because the Nazis killed us because we were not white. And in fact, that is the origin of the term anti-Semitism. The Jews are one of the Semitic races. And in order for the Nazis to justify why they were persecuting the Jews is because they were not white, because they were Semitic, because they were inferior to the white races. Fast forward now, the narrative has been completely reversed, and now Jews are white colonial oppressors.
Well, in South Africa, and I know you're going down to Cape Town, and I don't know if you're going to see Milton Shane, who is one of the top scholars in South Africa, just about the Jewish religion and Jewish people in South Africa and their history. There's a very fascinating, and we can go down a rabbit hole about why Jewish people in South Africa are seen as white. In fact, the Afrikaners, the National Party, in order to make it palatable, they actually had the Jewish question, how they're going to deal with Jews in South Africa. And to get over that, this is how the European versus non-European became a thing, and then white versus non-white. And that's how Jewish people in South Africa became white.
Jews are historically the oldest, most persecuted minority community in human history. And what struck me so much when I toured the Apartheid Museum together with a gentleman named Howie Saxteen, who is a national treasure and a wonderful person. You got to have him on your podcast.
He's a friend.
Oh, fabulous. Did he introduce us? I can't remember. What a whirlwind. So, he explained to me the Jewish contribution to the anti-apartheid movement. And the reason why it was so natural is because we just came from the Holocaust. And what struck me were the parallels of how the apartheid regime applied their race laws to the blacks were exactly parallel to what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany. And the response, right, the anti-apartheid movement working together with Jewish activists, with Jewish lawyers, even the phrase, and this was really striking to me, the anti-apartheid movement adopted the phrase, never again. It was all over their posters, never again the ANC, never again will we allow black people to be treated like this. Never again is the same phrase that was adopted by the Jews to say, never again will we have a Holocaust. And now we must advocate that there should be never again is now for both of our communities. The other parallels that I saw were the, like you said, the white Afrikan Nazis doing the Nazi salutes, wearing the same Nazi uniforms as the German Nazis did. The pictures of how they set up the black housing areas was
the townships,
same, the townships, yeah. The same plan, how they did Buchenwald, the concentration camps, and there needs to be a greater exploration of how minority rights struggles, particularly the Jewish struggle for civil rights, is parallel to the black struggle for civil rights. And I'll say something very bold, but I'll stand by it. You know, the Jewish community has been a part of almost every single civil rights and minority rights movement on this planet, and we've been an instrumental part of it. Now is the time that we need your help. We need the help of allies, especially the black community, to help advocate for our civil rights, to fight against the historical revisionist narrative that Jews are not indigenous to Judea, that we're somehow oppressing the local population, where the complete opposite is true. Israel is the only place where minority rights are respected in the Middle East. It's the only place where we have Muslim members of Knesset. It's the only place where we have a gay pride parade.
So when you hear the phrasing of Zionists and Zionism mm-hmm. as a colonialist project, as oppressive, what is and the conflation, because I think, you know, there are Jewish people here in South Africa who are not mm-hmm. in Israel, who are not even ascribing to some of what the politics in Israel is like. There are Jewish people all over the world. Mm-hmm. Are the two things the same?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. You have to just look at the map of the Middle East, right? And the Jewish state is this tiny, tiny speck amongst a sea of Islamist countries, of Muslim-majority countries. And you ask, who are the colonialists? Who are the ones that are oppressing the minorities in their population? Why is it that in every single Muslim-majority country, there is a very active black slave trade? Why is it that we have gender, race, and religious apartheid happening in every single Muslim majority country? And when you say, well, you know, is Judaism and Zionism, are they one and the same, or are they distinct? You know, Zionism is an integral part of the Jewish identity. It's part of our race, our ethnicity, our culture. And what it has come to mean in the political sense is the basic view that Jews have a right to self-sovereignty, that Jews have a right to live in their indigenous homeland to protect themselves and to govern themselves. And if you do not believe that Jews have the same civil rights, human rights, and sovereign rights as other nationalities, then you, my friend, are the bigot.
And for you, when you then hear people who say, but we don't believe that in Palestine or the way the Palestinian state and Gaza, and particularly, and I will keep talking about this because this is the war that we are currently every day hearing about and listening to, right? There is a consistent and ongoing strife between Hamas in Gaza. I keep asking, what has happened to the PLO? Because when I grew up, the PLO were the big...
They're a designated, you know, terrorist group.
And why it is that these individuals have this ongoing strife mm-hmm. with each other. And what does it look like to find each other and find peace Is it possible to have peace with Israel and its neighbors? Never mind the extra governmental organizations, which are designated as terrorist groups, but those countries in the Middle East around Israel. And, you know, and we can talk a little bit about the Abrahamic Accords. Is it possible to find peace? And what does that look like? Okay.
So it all comes back again to when I was 24 years old and I was filming my documentary. And, you know, after 9/11, we kept asking ourselves as a Western civilization, you know, why do they hate us? What did we do to deserve so much hate? Why do they hate us so much that they're willing to fly two planes into the Twin Towers and kill themselves while they're killing other civilians? And I realized when I was filming the movie that that was the wrong question. Okay, the wrong question is what have we done to deserve this hate? The right question is, why are millions of Muslim children being taught to hate life and to love death? The greatest crime against humanity is to teach a child to hate. No child is born with Jew hatred in their hearts. And the inconvenient truth that I risked my life to expose, that I traveled to Jenin, Ramallah, Tulkarm, and Nablus for 2 years, and I secured firsthand interviews with leaders of terrorist organizations, families of suicide bombers. I went into schools run by Islamic Jihad, kindergarten schools. We went into UNRWA schools. I went into prisons. I interviewed children who were arrested for attempting to blow themselves up. And what I learned is that from infancy, Palestinian Muslim children are taught to hate Jews, that it is their religious obligation to engage in jihad and to kill themselves for the sake of jihad. So much so that when I interviewed the leader of the Al-Aqsa Modern Brigades in Jenin, Zakaria Zubeidi, who at that time was the number one most wanted man in the West Bank, he told me that children, and he had been responsible for recruiting dozens of children, he told me that children come to him so willingly that if he didn't give them a bomb, they would just go use a knife instead. Because the jihad and the shahada, which is martyrdom, is about fame. It's about recognition. It's about wanting to earn your place in heaven. And when I interviewed 8, 9, 10-year-olds, and the reason why I risked my life to do this is so that I could document from the mouths of the victims and the perpetrators themselves so that nobody could tell me I was lying. When I interviewed these children, they described to me in detail what would happen after they blow themselves up. One child told me that she was going to build a 4-story house full of marble and she was going to have a carnival outside and invite all of her family because they don't believe that when you blow your limbs to pieces that you're going to die. I went into a kindergarten school and we sat children around in the school and we said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And every child said, shaheed, shaheed, martyr. Right? And then when one child said, I want to be a teacher, the teacher corrected the child and said, no, tell the camera you want to be shaheed. When there is a culture in a society of war and hatred, when you see what they're teaching the 6, 7, 8-year-olds, that's what the future is going to look like. Peace is possible when children are not educated to hate. And that is the root cause of the conflict in the Middle East, hate education. It's not a battle over land. It's not about Ariel Sharon who walked on the Temple Mount or, you know, it's a theological religious war. And is peace possible? Of course it is. But it's not up to the Jewish community to impose it. The community has to take responsibility for themselves. They have to love their children more than they love conflict. And I'll end with one more thing. I find it a little bit, and I'm not saying you, but it's a general thing that's going on, insulting that Palestinian has been used as a Muslim, exclusively Muslim identity. Okay, before the state of Israel was created, the area, it's a geographical location, was called Palestine. My ancestors identified as Palestinian. My ancestors had Palestinian as their identification on their passports. The Jerusalem Post used to be called the Palestine Post. The Israel Philharmonic Orchestra used to be called the Palestinian Orchestra. This was never an exclusive Muslim identity until the 1970s. And in order to gain legal parity with the Jewish community, Yasser Arafat, who was Egyptian, he was born in Egypt, invented an exclusive Muslim-Palestinian identity so that he could legally challenge the Jewish people in terms of their sovereign claim to the land. And finally, everyone says, well, we need to create a Palestinian state, whatever that means. In my opinion, I think creating a Palestinian Islamist state in a sea of failed dictatorships is not going to lead us anywhere to peace. That's not a solution. And we tried that in Gaza. The Jews took every single last man, woman, and child, and we even exhumed the dead bodies of Jews buried in the land from Gaza. We took it out. We left them the greenhouses. We left them to self-government, and we pumped billions of dollars from Qatar, for example, and also from the world into the creation of a Palestinian entity, a so-called Palestinian Muslim entity in Gaza. And the facts speak for themselves. The issue is one of culture. When the culture of hatred changes, when mosques and Islamists are not preaching death to the infidels, death to the Jews, death to the Christians, and we see the result of that in Mozambique, ISIS, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Al-Qaeda,
Sudan, Nigeria.
And we have to understand, it's not so much about pro-Israel advocacy. Frankly, my job is not to make people love Israel. Okay, why is it the Jewish job to go around and make people love Israel? My job.
I want to ask this as a last question. Finish this thought and then one last question.
Is to make sure that we all share the same threat. All understand that we share the same threat, which is radicalization and hate education. And when they say globalize the intifada, what they mean is to bring that hate education to devalue and dehumanize the other, whether it's the Jew, whether it's the Black, so that they can justify a violent campaign of annihilation and genocide. And that is what is going on.
So this, just to take it out of the Middle East for a second and look at it at a global scale, growing anti-Semitism. And for a lot of people, when they're called out for anti-Semitism, the answer tends to be, no, actually being anti-Zionist, being anti the colonialist Israeli project is not the same as anti-Semitism. And how do you respond to that?
So, look, I call it Jew hatred. And I give you a bracelet that says, end Jew hatred. The fact of the matter is that for the last couple hundred years, if not more, a litany of excuses has been used to target and kill Jews. And, you know, when in communism, Jews were capitalists. In capitalist societies, Jews are communists. Jews are rich, they should be killed, or Jews are poor and dirty and they're vermin and spreading disease and they should be killed. And now what you have is the projection of your hatred of a foreign state or in so-called Israeli-Palestinian conflict on someone because they're Jewish and you treat them differently. My job is to file civil rights lawsuits on behalf of Jewish persons and communities around the world. And every plaintiff is different. The fact pattern is always different, but one thing remains the same. Jews are being treated differently. They're being oppressed. They're being targeted with assaults and violence and harassment and civil rights violations because they are Jewish, no matter the litany of excuses. I represented students in San Francisco State University, and they were the university refused to allow them to put a table to advertise for their Jewish entity, a non-political Jewish group called Hillel. The university said, this is a Zionist-free zone, so you cannot participate. So we sued the school for unlawful discrimination. And to our surprise, well, maybe not to our surprise, the school said, you're right. It wasn't a fact at dispute. This is a Zionist-free zone. We did not allow them to table, not because we're anti-Semitic. We have nothing against Jews, but because they're anti-Zionist, and Zionism is a political point of view, and that's not protected by your, you know, California anti-discrimination law. It protects discrimination against race, ethnicity, national identity, gender, you know, and so forth. But your political positions are not a protected category under our law, so we're free to say that your political positions are not welcome here. So to that, we responded, number one, who are you to tell my client what their Zionism is to them? That's like a white person telling a Black person what anti-Black racism is and what the Black experience is. You cannot. Zionism for our clients, as I mentioned earlier, is a part of their ethnic identity. We pray towards Jerusalem. We say every year, next year in Jerusalem at our Passover Seders. Israel is center to our religious identity. You just have to read the Bible to understand that. And we believe that there should be a state for the Jews because of the persecution that we've been victimized by for centuries. However, even if Zionism is only a political point of view, only Jews are given a political litmus test as a precondition to participate. So for example, the school isn't going to the Chinese Student Association and saying, yo, what's your position on China's handling of COVID? And unless you're a good Chinese student and you criticize the Chinese government, you can't participate. We don't go to the Muslim Student Association and ask them, you know, what is your position on Iranian nuclear disarmament? And unless you agree, we're not going to let you participate. Only the Jews, they say, because of your politics, because of your identity, we're not going to let you participate here unless you renounce it. That in and of itself is discriminatory. And to those who want to protest, who those who take to the streets in extreme ignorance of the facts on the ground to protest for the Palestinian people, you know what I ask them? Have they ever criticized the use of Muslim children for theological warfare? Have they ever criticized Hamas for using hospitals as their headquarters, for hiding rockets? We went into schools, UNRWA schools, where rockets were hidden under the schools. The schools were used as rocket launching facilities. Why do they do that? Because they know that the West doesn't give a shit about the lives of Muslim children. Because if they did, they would criticize the Hamas. But what they want to do is create a situation where Israel is forced to respond to a terrorist threat. They use civilians as human shields. They use children as suicide homicide bombers. They use women as bombers. Because they know that when Israel retaliates, they will cry war crimes. They will engage in a lawfare attack. They will use the legal system to paint Israel as a human rights violator when the terrorists themselves are engaged in asymmetric warfare and using civilians as human shields. That is their MO. And that is what this BDS movement and all these movements that accuse Israel of war crimes are engaging in. They don't understand the facts on the ground. And what I encourage them to do is don't even listen to me. Pick yourself up and go to Israel. See for yourself. You owe it to yourself to do a fact-finding mission and come to your own conclusion about what's going on there.
I think that's a good place to end. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your time and thank you for your passion and spending it with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I hope you enjoy the rest of your trip here.
Thank you. I will.